Now Jeff Blair can tell you bedtime stories. Subscribe to podcasts of The Jeff Blair Show at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher and listen anytime you want. Sweet dreams. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Three things you're not supposed to talk about in polite company. Politics, religion, and money. Better add sports, too. And since he's not always polite company, he'll maybe address all four. Jeff Blair and the Jeff Blair Show. Now. On Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Jonathan Gatehouse and McLean's and Raphael Honigstein. And just ahead of Baseball Central. This has been the oddest Leafs preseason ever. I don't remember a time since I've been in this city where a Leafs preseason has been as, I don't know if under-discussed is the word. That's probably not true. But, man, it seems as if there's no discussion or no narrative around this team at all. I guess other than, does William Nylander stay? And is this team really as bad as Mike Babcock appears to be preparing us all for it to be? Scott Morrison's our Hockey Central analyst on Sportsnet. You can follow him on Twitter at MorrisonSnet. Mr. Morrison, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well, Jeff. How are you?
I'm doing well, but I got to tell you, man, it almost seems as if Mike Babcock wishes this season wouldn't happen. As if we could just fast forward it to the end of April and he could hold his wrap-up news conference and say, well, I told you guys it was going to be rough and it's going to be better next year, and then everybody could leave and go up to the cottage.
Well, you know, it's interesting because prior to Mike getting hired, he had told people, you know, and it was still in limbo whether or not he was going to stay in Detroit or not, and he had told people about he's an instant gratification kind of guy. And I think when he said that, a lot of us read between the lines that perhaps he wasn't the guy for the Toronto rebuild or restoration, whatever you want to call it, because he hates that rebuild word. But obviously everything evolved the way it did. You know, I think Mike is staring at this, and we saw sort of the first taste of impatience, if you will, from him this week. He tried to downplay things with respect to effort, but talked about still that he was disappointed with the play of his veteran players, that they weren't carrying the ball, the kids were, and that he's spending more time explaining than he is teaching. So I think this week he expected more from the lineup he put on the ice in Buffalo the other night, and maybe that was the first time it really hit him between the eyes. You know, you can talk about it, you can look at the paper and your depth chart and all the rest of it and kind of know that you've got a challenge ahead of you, but maybe that was the first time from an on-ice perspective it really hit him between the eyes just how far this team has to go and how potentially bad it's going to be this season.
You know, I think the thing that kind of surprises me about some of what we're hearing from Mike Babcock, and I shouldn't say surprised because I think it kind of validates what a lot of people are thinking, but it's gone beyond the "I wish the veterans would try harder" into, it seems to me anyhow, Scott, essentially questioning just how good they are. You know, it's not just simply a matter of they're not trying hard. It's these guys just may not be that good. And again, that shouldn't come as a newsflash to anybody. But it's one thing to hear me say it or you say it or other people in the media say it. But when you hear it from the coach, you know, if I'm somebody paying money to go watch this, I'm scratching my head right now.
Well, I suppose, Jeff, at the end of the day, you still, with the, you know, exception of Phil Kessel, who's moved on, and a few smaller pieces, excuse me, you've still got the nucleus of the team that won 11 of its final 51 games on the ice, surrounded by a bunch of guys who are by and large journeyman players who have bounced from team to team to team over the last few years. You've got two goalies, neither of whom has established themselves as a number one. You've got holes on defense. You've got some old guys on defense. On and on it goes. And probably two of your best players from the camp, when you think about how Brown and Nylander have played, are going to go to the Marlies. Then it is, what you've got is the same kind of team you had last year, and you just hope that he can somehow teach them to be better and force an effort that will make them be better on some nights. But I don't think he was kidding, and he knew exactly what he was saying the very first day when he said there was going to be a lot of pain.
The Leafs will wrap up their preseason schedule tonight in Detroit. Saturday, they play the Red Wings at home, and I know it is the return of Mike Babcock to Detroit, but I've got to think in some ways, obviously that'll be a narrative out of this game, but I think that game in Detroit next weekend will probably be when it really kind of sinks in for Mike Babcock, won't it? At that point, when the games start to matter, he may be standing behind the bench going, oh my God, what did I get myself into?
Or what did I walk away from?
What did I walk away from, exactly. Yeah.
But, because there was going to be a decimal point and a lot of zeros anywhere he stood back this season. But, I think tonight, there'll be something when he walks in the rink and sees a lot of familiar faces. But I think it'll really hit home, to your point, Jeff, when the regular season starts and he goes into that building and everything starts to unfold and the games matter for real. What's on the line tonight for this team? He's got two games in which he's got to see a goaltender step up, and he's been very much assuring that there will be a number one goalie this year, and there's not going to be a goalie debate, and he doesn't like to have a situation where he has to answer who's starting on any given day, but he needs somebody to step up and prove that they're the guy. I would think Bernier might be the guy just based on his contract and his history and what seems to be the feeling about him in the organization. Having said that, there's some that feel that Reimer's been a little bit better than him in this preseason, but nobody has stepped out ahead of the other. So they're both going to get a chance to play over the weekend, and they really need somebody to step up and say, hey, I'm that guy, and put him in a position where he's your starter on Wednesday night when you open the season against the Canadiens. Beyond that, I think the roster appears to be pretty set, and it'd be interesting to see if any of those kids, how much time they get, if any, over these last two games, and whether they can sway the opinion on whether they should be starting with this team or going back to the Marlboros, and that'll be an interesting debate for sure. But I just wanted to say too, Jeff, as you're talking about the Leafs and just how far off the radar they are, and that's really how last season ended, didn't it? It was just total indifference,
yeah, that's
the worst
true.
Possible reaction yeah. you can have.
That's absolutely true.
Yeah. And I'm not sure, I think Babcock's hiring may have stoked the fires a little bit in the off season, but because of what's happening with the baseball team and again, this team being so underwhelming in its camp, I think they've fallen off the map a little bit. But back in 93, as you recall, and I was involved in some of the coverage of the Jays' run then in the World Series, the Leafs got off to a 10-0 start, and hardly anybody noticed
that season
because of a World Series run. So I think there's a combination of factors overshadowed by the brilliance of the Jays and maybe undershadowed, if there's such a word, by their own awful play last season and the indifference that surrounded them.
Scott, I wanted to ask you about the news out of New York this week about expansion and kind of, I think, what a lot of people saw as Gary Bettman in some ways putting the brakes on it a little bit. It seemed to me from a distance, and I know John Shannon and some other people share this opinion too, but Scott, it seemed to me from a distance that essentially what he was doing was almost playing a delay game in order to allow Seattle to get its ducks in order. Is it that simple? Because it really does seem as if, Las Vegas, everybody seems to be on board with that, or at least it seems to be looking up. But you really get the sense that Gary's got another city out there, and it's not necessarily Quebec City. that he wants to see in the league for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is geography, and that really what he was doing was sort of sending signals to the folks in Seattle that there's still some time here, get your ducks in order, and we'll move quickly when you're ready.
Well, it's certainly possible that you slow that process and you give them a little bit of time, because it's the West is where you need the teams. There's no doubt about that. And you keep, under that scenario or that theory, if you will, and then you would keep perhaps a Quebec City in advance for, similar situation of what happened with Winnipeg, of getting a team to move, a troubled franchise to move into that market, and then you use the other ones as your expansion market. So that quite possibly could be the case. It might also be, Jeff, is the $500 million. That's a huge number.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's great that Las Vegas has had people sign up and say, we want tickets, this, that, and the other. But $500 is a huge number to finance. And I think, that's pretty good reason in itself to go slow and be checking and double-checking that the people are putting up this money or trying to put up this money, certainly from the Vegas standpoint, are going to be rock solid, because you just don't need to invite another struggling, bottom 10 team that's just going to be a revenue share and be battling the way, say, a Florida is or an Atlanta was. You don't want to bring that on. And in the case of Quebec City, it's great that they've assured that the dollar isn't a factor, but 500 becomes $640-ish million dollars. It's a huge factor.
And
you've got to make sure that they can tread water and all of that and be able to price themselves to be able to make it a good business model.
No, absolutely. I think that, it's nice that the NHL moved to sort of quell any sense of panic about the Canadian dollar, but the impact is still real, and you can't get around that. The impact of the Canadian dollar, the value of the Canadian dollar, is still very real in a financial sense.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And it's real for a team like, potential franchise Quebec that has to write the kind of checks they'd have to write to get mm-hmm. into the league. And it also impacts the league itself, because we all know that the Canadian teams are a huge part of the revenue stream, revenue generators in this league, in the top third. So it has an impact all around. And maybe Gary's looking at it, the overall economy of his league is, it's been rock solid. They grow every year. They expect their revenues to be in the $4 billion range. But he also knows that a 75-cent dollar is going to have an overall impact, not just on the Canadian teams, but on others as well. So maybe, your plan is a good one. You've got a couple of good entities ready to step into your league, but you don't have to do everything right away. You can slow it down, and a year from now may not be a bad time. It may be a better time, in fact, to do it.
Scott, I appreciate you doing this morning. Thanks so much.
Okay, Jeff, take care. Enjoy the baseball playoffs.
Thank you. Scott Morrison of Sportsnet. The Leafs will get their season going Wednesday. And it's an interesting point Scott made about 93. The Leafs got off to that 10-0 start, and nobody even noticed it. I guess what really surprises me, and I maybe this is just Mike Babcock. Maybe I'm just used to people spinning stuff. But, I'm sitting here reading Rob Longley's piece in The Sun. And just listen to this quote from Mike Babcock. "There isn't one guy here who is not trying. But under the pressure, under the gun, they've always gone back to who they are. Who you are has to have winning habits. It's got to be over and over and over again." And I find this statement remarkable. "I spend half my time explaining the drill instead of teaching. Once they get where to go, then we can teach them more." Think about that. I spend half my time explaining the drill instead of teaching. It sounds to me as if this may not be the most intellectually gifted of groups, in addition to being pretty lousy on the ice. That is a remarkable statement from a coach. And I get that part of the deal with the Leafs is really, really underselling the product this year to people. really convincing people that you're taking this thing down to the bare bones, down to the foundation, and you're going to build it back up. But man, when you hear things like that, when you read statements like that, it's almost to the point where if I'm the Leafs, and I know Toronto hockey fans are still going to go to games, but there's also the matter of television and radio ratings. And if I'm the Leafs, I've got to start thinking about what can I do to get people excited about this team? Because having my head coach, as great a head coach as he may be, having my head coach stand there and basically tell the public that he's got a bunch of veterans who can't understand drills. I mean, if that's guerrilla marketing, it's an interesting type of guerrilla marketing. Marcelo Boo is the president of the Canadian Olympic Committee. If you've ever met Marcelo Boo, and I have had an opportunity to interview him on a couple of occasions, mostly when he was the president of the Quebec Nordique and I was working in Montreal. Oh, he's an engaging guy. He's really an outgoing guy. I've always kind of thought he's a bit of a $3 bill, but that's okay because in that capacity, you need to be able to kind of BS people. Well, Marcelo Boo has stepped aside from his job as head of the COC amidst what seems to be a growing list of allegations focusing on his sexual harassment of staffers. And some of them are, you know, pretty forward. Unwanted advances, including fondling, touching, forcibly kissing. You know, we're not talking, gee, you look nice. Jonathan Gatehouse is a senior correspondent for Maclean's. He's written extensively about sports, about Marcelo Boo, about the Olympics. Jonathan Gatehouse joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. Jonathan, thanks a lot for doing this morning.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Boy, this is, you know, I mean, the list of harassment that we're seeing in the newspaper stories, and a lot of this is, I mean, a lot of this, you can imagine, it's just red meat for a lot of the Quebec media. But it looks as if we're talking about a list of things, which really surprises me, because I've got to think that the COC would have done some sort of, you know, you would have done some sort of due diligence in this guy.
Well, you know, I think, firstly, he had a bit of a reputation. I don't think it was necessarily a reputation that he would say of, how would we describe it, as improper behavior? I think as questionable behavior, perhaps.
He was a bit of a flirt. He was a flirt.
He's gregarious. He's a very physical man. I've, you know, certainly he's a huggy guy, and, you know, some women obviously were uncomfortable with that. I'd certainly witnessed that in the past in dealings with him where, you know, women would get up and sort of move to the other side of the room when Marcel came in because they didn't want to get involved in what it was to be greeting Marcel. But, you know, I think, listen, there's, as you alluded to, there's a lot more coming out almost by the hour now. The press in Montreal has a story this morning where they've obtained a letter that the COC sent to Marcel early on in his tenure in 2011, where they sat him down and read him the Riot Act and said, you cannot touch staff anymore. You cannot make sexual comments in front of staff. You cannot kiss staffers. And apparently this all revolved around an incident that happened in Moncton in front of a bunch of Olympians and staffers. And, you know, and they said that at the time that he agreed that he was not going to do this stuff.
How much of a setback for this is, or how much of a setback for the COC is this? Because, you know, the Toronto Olympic bid, leave that aside. There'd been a lot of talk that Quebec City, Calgary may in fact want to put together a bid for the Winter Olympics. Marcelo Boo is a guy, Jonathan, who, I mean, he's like, I think the Globe and Mail is a story where he's described as a bulldozer. He gets things done. And that's That's Marcelo Boo. I mean, he basically runs over you in order to get from point A to point B. He is a shaker and mover. He's probably the right type of guy in terms of his political skills to be head of the COC. But how much of a setback is this to the cause of the Olympics in Canada?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've got to, this is one of those things that people are going to have to try and balance, right? I mean, do you want, can you support a guy like this being in charge of, a movement that has some other ideals about equality and inclusion? But clearly, in the capacity, like the professional capacity, he's done a pretty good job. I mean, he's raised the profile of the movement. He has raised a ton of money from corporate Canada. He's as you mentioned, he has a lot of connections, a lot of political friends, both in Canada. You know, he's managed to secure very stable funding from the federal Tories, and I think that if push had come to shove, that he might well have been able to get an Olympics for Toronto or an Olympics for Calgary or wherever else. I mean, he is a connected guy, but it's hard to see him as these allegations unravel surviving in that job.
What are you, who would be a candidate to replace him? You know, I mean, we've heard Mark Tewksbury would be a guy whose name comes up right away. I don't know. What do you need for this job, Jonathan? You need a certain amount of business savvy. Do you need to be a CEO? Do you need to be a lawyer? What do you need to do this job?
That's been in the past, right? That you've had people that were lawyers or sort of, you know, had broadcasting experience maybe because of that component, helping to take care of the deals and the like and the relationships. But I mean, it's hard to say. Like, it's an elected job. I think people lose sight of that a lot. You serve because you are elected by the various sporting federations and the people, the Olympians that have votes in this process. And so you got to have the confidence of people within the Canadian sporting community. And so someone like a Tewksbury, if he was interested in the job, might well be that kind of guy. I mean, there's a number of other Canadians who have had high-profile positions within the Olympic movement. I haven't seen anybody who put their name forward yet because supposedly this is a temporary withdrawal from the job for Obu. But, you know, if this does unravel the way it looks like it's going to, they're going to have to find somebody else.
This job, in the past, I mean, it's been held by a variety of people, and you know, I've got to think, Jonathan, that given what I think is it's a legitimate move by the IOC to kind of clean up its act. And I don't know if it's never going to be completely clean, obviously, but I think they're trying to move towards something vaguely resembling transparency. They're trying to move away, I think,
a kinder, gentler mafia.
A kinder, gentler mafia, exactly. A cleaner FIFA, yeah. I guess it'd be a cleaner FIFA would be the way to put it. But I mean, look, the IOC's generally got such a bad, you know, it's got such an eye rolling reputation. But it seems to me that the COC in Canada is actually, its reputation's probably better than that of the IOC, or has been better than that of the IOC in general, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, Canadians have a great deal of affection for Olympians in the Olympic movement. And certainly, you know, we like to believe that we uphold some values of playing fair and promoting equality and standing up against some of these issues that have been there in the Olympic movement, like in the Sochi Games with the anti-gay laws that Putin had passed. But yeah, this is a definite problem for them going forward. I mean, you can't, it's hard to see how you can sustain having a guy who has this growing reputation as someone who crosses the line on a regular basis when it comes to the women that work for him or just women that he meets out when he's representing the COC.
Jonathan, we're going to let you run. Appreciate you doing this.
Thanks very much.
It's Jonathan Gatehouse, senior correspondent for McLean. So Marcelo Boo has stepped down as head of the COC, and there is, amidst a growing list of allegations, sexual harassment allegations against him. And again, Jonathan makes a good point. Anybody who's talked to Boo, he's a physical guy. And in some ways, given given what we now understand, or I think given the wider and quite frankly more appropriate definition we have of sexual harassment, there should have been red flags. Absolutely. But let's see where it goes. As we said, so far there are allegations, although the list of allegations continues to grow. And it'll be interesting to see who replaces. I mean, there are a number. There's Chris Overholt, former CEO of was he CEO of Own the Podium or CEO of the COC? This Chris Overholt would be a candidate. I've got to think Mark Tewksbury would be a candidate. There may be a move to bring in some sort of former politician as a candidate to lead the COC. I would think there'd probably be a lot of support for Mark Tewksbury, although, again, this job traditionally has belonged to somebody who has an extensive background in finance or in law. So it'll be interesting to see how that job gets filled and whether or not there is any long-term impact on the possibility of Calgary or Quebec City getting the Winter Olympics. There's a book that has just been released called Das Reboot. Great title for a book. You know, probably know the movie Das Boot. It's a play on that. It's about how German soccer reinvented itself and conquered the world and went on to win the 2014 World Cup. Now, if you're a soccer fan, you'll find it interesting. If you're a soccer fan, you might even be surprised to know that it took 30 years, that Germany went 30 years between World Cup wins. Everybody just kind of assumes Germany owns the World Cup, which, in point of fact, doesn't happen. But there's some similarities. There are some similarities to what we went through in Canada with hockey. I mean, German soccer at some point had to sit down and take a look at itself and ask, are we producing the type of players we need to produce in order to win in the world stage? I mean, German soccer was a little bit at a point where Canadian hockey was. We're Canada, we're here, give us the gold medal, we need to go home. So it's a fascinating look with a lot of anecdotes, a fascinating look at how a country sat down and redefined its national sport. The author of the book is Raphael Honigstein. He's a UK-based journalist. He's a columnist for The Guardian. He's on BT Sport. He writes for ESPN. It's not a soccer book. It's a sports book about how an entire country sat down to redefine itself in its national sport. Raphael Honigstein will join us when the Jeff Bliss Show continues on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590, The Fan on demand. Now more of the Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
The corner of my eye, I saw a pretty little thing approaching me. She said, I never seen a man who looks so all alone. Could you use a little company? If you pay the right price, your evening will be nice and you can go and send me on my way.
All right, we'll have a full weekend of footy for you on Sportsnet. Barclays Premier League action and Major League Soccer in Sportsnet this weekend. Saturday's first game, 9:30 a.m. in Sportsnet East Ontario, West and Pacific, will be Manchester City, or as we refer to them, the second team in Manchester, against Newcastle United, also at 9:30 on Sportsnet 1, Aston Villa and Stoke City. Sportsnet World at 9:30 will have Sunderland against West Ham. Chelsea and Southampton will go at 12 p.m. in Sportsnet East Ontario, West Pacific, and Sportsnet World. And Toronto FC will play the Philadelphia Union at 5 p.m. on Sportsnet 360. Sunday, Swansea City will take on Tottenham Hotspur. That'll be at 10:30 a.m. again on Sportsnet East Ontario, West and Pacific. Plus, we will have our regular slate of Bundesliga action this weekend. Today, at 2 p.m. in Sportsnet World, it'll be SV Darmstadt against Mainz. Saturday, it'll be Borussia Mönchengladbach against Wolfsburg. That'll be a 4 p.m. tape delay in Sportsnet World. Sunday, Schalke against Cologne and Bayern Munich against Borussia Dortmund. Schalke and Cologne is 9:30 a.m. on Sportsnet World. Bayern and Borussia Dortmund is at 11:30 a.m. on Sportsnet World. And that's the one to watch. Raphael Honigstein is a UK-based journalist. He's a columnist for The Guardian. He's a pundit on BT Sport, ESPN, as well as The Guardian's terrific Football Weekly podcast. He's written a new book called Das Reboot. I'm going to call it Das Reboot. Das Reboot, How German Soccer Reinvented Itself and Conquered the World. And it explains, in essence, how German soccer took, well, it took kind of a deep look into its soul after 30 years without a World Cup before going on to win the 2014 event in Brazil. And if you're a hockey fan of a certain age, you'll detect a lot of similarities between what the Germans did and what Canada had to do years ago in our own national sport. And this is what I found really fascinating about the book. Yeah, it's a soccer book. It's about German soccer. There's a lot of good anecdotes, but there's a lot of cross-cultural, cross-sport tie-ins to this book. It's an intriguing look at how German soccer went from, well, a blandly efficient machine to some sort of wonderfully creative, multi-ethnic juggernaut. And we're very pleased to have Raphael Honigstein on the Jeff Blair Show. Rafa, thanks for joining us. Terrific work. For our listeners, many of whom may not be soccer fans, just give us a brief synopsis of the book. And let me ask you this. Why was it important that German soccer reinvent itself?
Well, German football, German soccer was really stuck in the past. You know, it had been the most successful European nation for a long time, and they just started to rest on their laurels. They just believed by simply being Germany, being a country that's rich, that has a lot of people, a lot of footballers, they would go on to dominate and win titles. But they turned around and they completely fell asleep, and within 10 years after winning the World Cup in 1990, they found themselves literally 10 years adrift of what other nations were doing in terms of the tactics, in terms of the fitness, in terms of preparation. Germany were really stuck in the past, and it took them a long time to realize that they really needed to change. They needed to learn from their rivals. They needed to adapt. They needed to make wholesale changes at grassroots levels when it came to developing young players who were no longer any good, were no longer being produced in sufficient numbers and quality. And all these things started to happen. And thankfully for Germany, the sort of revolution from below, you know, with people changing the development and being a lot smarter when it came to producing young players, and the revolution on the top, Jürgen Klinsmann, a dynamic new manager taking over, a real guy coming in from the warm, as it were, from California, to take German football into modernity. Those two things collided at a certain point. And then it was almost inevitable that they would, A, become pretty good again, and then B, eventually win a title, which of course they did in Brazil last year.
Rafa, how important was it that that there was buy-in from the top German clubs in order to get this thing going? Now, I know initially they fought it. I mean, as your book points out, a lot of the work, a lot of the groundwork here at the German league level was done sort of away from Bayern Munich, away from Dortmund, certainly until Jurgen Klopp took over, and done in some of the smaller clubs. But the fact that the Bundesliga seems to have kind of bought into this sort of grand concept, that seems to have been, if not a turning point, certainly something that helped cement this as a reality, didn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what Germany did in the late 90s and the early 2000s was look at France. France was seen as the model of European football when it came to harnessing talent and really becoming, you know, almost overnight, a real superpower in European football. And they did it through youth development. And the French model, though, was based very much on, initially, on a centralized approach. You would just scoop up all the best young French footballers and put them in a boarding school and train them incessantly. And then you end up with 20, 30 really good players. After the success of that model, though, the French clubs started having their own academies, and then basically the national academy had kind of become superfluous. mm-hmm. because everybody was being coached in the club level. So the Germans, coming very late to this whole thing, said, you know what, let's leave out the nationalized academy. Let's just make all the clubs, we have a lot of professional clubs, 36 in League One and Two, let's force them to have their own academies. Let's tell them, if you want to be in the Bundesliga, you have to have these academies, and the academies have to have a certain level of coaching, certain level of medical, psychological, fitness, all these things that are continually tested, optimized, and you get points and you get a bit of money if you do it right. And then the clubs realized, you know, actually this is brilliant, because why should we go and buy players in Slovakia and in the Czech Republic or from elsewhere if we can produce them ourselves? They're younger, they're cheaper. The fans really like them because they identify with them. They're local guys. They know the club. They know the sort of the corporate culture of the club. And it very quickly became from something that's seen as almost, you know, outrageous or really arduous on the club as something that everybody says, yeah, of course. Why didn't we think about this earlier?
Now, between 1974, Germany won the World Cup in 74. They won it in 90. I think I misspoke. I think I said it was 30 years between World Cup wins. And then, of course, in 2014, the other thing that happened, and I think we saw this in the World, especially in the World Cup that Germany hosted, Germany seemed to embrace its multi-ethnicity a little more. You started to see the Mesut Özils, you know, the Sami Khedira's, the Jerome Boateng. You started to see them come into the program. And Rafa, I'm wondering, how much did that influx of players from different backgrounds help this process along? Because it seems as if it almost forced the open approach to be more open, didn't it?
Yes. I think to a large extent it happened organically because, you know, these guys just happened to be the best players, and it was almost no longer relevant if your last name was Müller or Boateng or Khedira or Gomez. You just have a lot of immigration in Germany, and chances are that they will produce a lot of really good footballers. But what did change was two things. First of all, in 1998, the then government of Germany said, you know, let's really modernize our citizenship law. It was very restrictive. You had second generation, third generation immigrants who could not become Germans because they couldn't prove any German lineage. You needed to prove German ethnicity to get a passport. It wasn't a system that you have in the States. You know, you're born there, you automatically got a passport, or elsewhere, you lived there for a certain time, you get a passport. Germany was very restrictive. Unless you were actually German or had German parents or grandparents, no passport for you. So in the late 90s, they changed that. So all of a sudden, guys like Özil, you know, who for 10 years ago wouldn't have had a chance to actually be German, could be German. So that was one big thing politically. The other thing was that the German FA also said, you know, we're missing out on a lot of really good players. In 2002, Turkey, not exactly a superpower in football, went to the semi-final of the World Cup. And about six of those players were born in Germany and could have, in theory, represented Germany. So the German FA doubled down on their efforts to target these guys and say, you know what, we can understand that you have a background and, you know, you might have some loyalty to the country of your parents or where you come from originally, but think about us. You know, if you feel German, if you feel that this is now your football country, come and play for us. And mm-hmm. then you get the Khedira's, then you get the Mesut Özil. So now it's almost no longer a question. If there is somebody who is Turkish and German, they're more likely to choose Germany.
Rafa, we just got a couple of minutes left. What sort of broad, wide-ranging lessons are there for other sports from the German example? Or is this something that you think is maybe specific to Germany?
Well, there are some stuff that is specific. It helps if you have 80 million people and 6 million out of them play football. You know, chances are you will have a decent team, mm-hmm. unless you really mess up. And Germany, of course, did mess up big time before that. But I would say there are one or two universal lessons that are applicable for everybody in every sport, is that you should try and filter out the noise. You know, when Germany weren't doing well, people were saying, oh, it's because there's too many kids playing PlayStation today. They're no longer playing football in the streets like we used to do or our parents used to do. They're too soft. Everybody's too well off in Germany. They're not hungry enough. They don't want it enough. They're not patriotic enough. They're getting paid too much money. They don't care about representing our nation anymore. all these things, that's the stuff that people talk about it on the pub with a beer in hand, completely irrelevant. The only thing that really matters is the quality of players you produce. And a nation like Germany should be able to produce 30, 40 world-class players if they're properly coached and if they get a chance to have regular football. Germany did that, and hey, presto, they're back to where they belong, which is the top of world football.
Raf, it was great of you to join us today. Thanks so much. It's a terrific book, and as I said, it's a book that will appeal to sports fans in addition to soccer fans. It is entitled Das Reboot, How German Soccer Reinvented Itself and Conquered the World. Thanks again for joining us, Raf. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's Raphael Honigstein. And yeah, the Guardians Football Podcast, which I've plugged in this show several times. It's a must listen if you're a footy fan. It's an awful lot of fun. And Raf is one of the regular contributors. So again, a full slate of Bundesliga action today, Saturday and Sunday. Sunday's big match, Bayern Munich against Borussia Dortmund. That'll be at 11:30 a.m. on Sportsnet World. And the usual slate of Barclays Premiership action, Chelsea and Southampton at 12 p.m. on Sportsnet East, Ontario, West, Pacific, and World on Saturday. That is, what am I doing here? It's time now for Baseball Central. I saw Kevin Barker in the room. I got confused. Ben Nicholson-Smith will join me, then Kevin Barker. We'll have Barker Goes Yard. Tom Grieve will join us. Dwayne Ward will join us. And yes, we will have Barker's Bundesliga picks. The man is 4-2. 4-2. Back with Baseball Central in the home of the Blue Jays, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.